Before we get started with this afternoon's activities, I'd like to remind everybody about this evening's activities. We're going to have a hacker court. We're going to try to run a working example of exactly what happens in the legal system this year. We're going to have a panel on vulnerabilities disclosure, a viewpoint from the federal government, as well as many of our speakers this year are also authors, and they will be available to sign books. And if you just happen to be missing the book, we have a bookstore up on the fourth floor near the registration booth. We'd like to invite you to come there and also enjoy the amenities at Black Hat. As a past member of NSA, I've graduated. It really pleases me to introduce our speaker today, Dickie George. He is of the Information Assurance Directorate of the National Security Agency. You will find from his speech that it's not a never say anything. We are becoming more public. Dickie joined NSA in 1970 as a mathematician and has worked in the Information Assurance Directorate the entire period as a crypto mathematician. He is the technical director of the Security Evaluation Group, which is responsible for evaluating security solutions used by the Department of Defense and the intelligence community. I'd like to encourage the audience to welcome Mr. Dickie George of NSA.
Thank you very much. It's interesting for me to be here. I speak at things not quite this big fairly often, but it always says top secret code word down here when I'm talking. I never have to worry about anybody repeating anything I have to say. One thing I would like to, I'd like you to feel free to ask questions as I go along. Don't hold them till the end. I think that sometimes it loses the impact when you wait till the end, and I'm happy to answer anything that I'm allowed to answer. If I'm not, I'll tell you I don't know. As Jack said, I started work at NSA in 1970, and I've worked in the Information Assurance Directorate ever since. To get this speech approved, and I had to go through umpteenth layers of bureaucracy, and they told me I had to read it word for word. If I changed anything, I would have to give them a call and ask them if I could change it. I may not strictly adhere to that, but I will do my best. So if it looks like I'm reading, it's because I'm trying to pay attention to the rules. Which is probably going to surprise a lot of my friends out there because that's typically not one of the things I like to do. I was asked to address my views on the future of IA and how NSA can work with the private sector to secure our critical infrastructure. I think that's a very important topic for me and for our agency. And I'd really like to start by saying that we really have to work together to do it because none of us can do it separately. It's too big a problem. All we have to do is figure out how we're going to do that. I want to go back a few years and talk to you about how things were when I started at the agency. And if this is reminiscing, it's because at my age, it's a lot easier to remember things that happened 30 years ago than last week. When I started at the agency, we were in the middle of the Cold War. It was great life. There was no competition between anything we were doing. We basically had authority and 30 years ago, authority actually meant something. People didn't challenge authority the way it's done today. So when we told a customer, you should do this, they jumped off and did it, rather than saying, well, why on earth would I want to do that? It was kind of actually pleasant. And, you know, it's kind of the same way with my kids. 20 years ago when I told them to do something, they actually did it. Yeah. Doesn't happen anymore. Now it's always, yeah right, Dad. We were really, 30 years ago, the only user of security products. And at that point in time, crypto was the game. Confidentiality was the question. We produced what were essentially boxes. And the fact that we had the mystique and the authority, it really meant that nobody challenged what we were doing. The world was very different. We had contractors building these things, much like there are contractors building things today, but they were in some sense a part of our family. They were captured contractors. They had clearances. They were U.S. citizens. It really was an extension of our agency. Very different from today. There really was no competition from COTS. There was no COTS time schedule. The issues that we addressed were very different than the issues that we have to address today. Interesting things it would happen. Like I went to a 3-day trip one time to deal with a product we were building. Out of the 3 days, they spent 1 hour talking about security. They spent an entire morning talking about what color the thing should be, whether it should be army green or navy blue. Very interesting. So those are the issues we faced back then. That's true, by the way. Confidentiality was the issue of the day. Data in storage was on paper. Data in transit was out in the air. That made it very easy to differentiate between data in storage and data that was in motion. And all the authorities, policies, whatever, were written to address those differences. It's no longer valid, and it's a big problem. The only other of the services that we really addressed was availability. That came into play in several issues. One in particular was when we deal with tactical military things. I'll give you an example. The military has to be able to communicate. Availability is really important in tactical situations. You're talking about an airplane flying overhead with an information friend or foe system. It's got to be able to respond. So they had a rule that said something like, if a box fails in any way, it's got to start transmitting in the clear. And, of course, a box in cipher mode has got to be able to receive in the clear. That's a rule. Well, that's a very hard rule to live with. I remember I was out at a different trip one time, and as I walked into the plant, there were two engineers. One was sitting in a chair and one was standing on a table. I was there for 3 days, and these two guys were there. They kept changing positions, but they're there. The guy standing on the table had one of our boxes and was throwing it on the ground, and the guy sitting in the chair would pick it up and hand it back to him. This was environmental testing in some sense to see if the thing could survive, because these things, you know, we had some crazy rules. Like, you know, we had one of our boxes, you had to be able, if you ran over it with a tank, it still had to work. But if you were being overrun by the enemy, you had to be able to destroy it in 10 seconds. Tough game. Well, these guys throwing the box on the ground were checking to see what would happen if something bad happened. They did it for 3 days. Still worked fine. This box was supposed to go into tanks. I assume most of you have fired tanks or been in tanks as they were fired. It's a different audience than I'm usually speaking to, apparently. There's a recoil, right? There's one heck of a recoil when you fire a tank. So they went to field test these things. And as they field tested it, there was a guy sitting there with a walkie-talkie, and all you heard was... And then he started hearing somebody talking. Pretty soon he heard another person talking. Within 5 minutes, he heard everybody talking. So what had happened? Well, all of the boxes had failed in a way, and so they all reverted to plain text. And everybody using the boxes didn't know. We managed to figure out what was wrong. What was wrong was the recoil was strong enough that it was bending the boards, causing it to fail. And it would immediately shift to plain text. So you talked perfectly securely in your tanks until you fired. Luckily, that was the field test. We got it fixed. It's all working fine now. Those are the interesting kind of things that happened. When you think of the network world, the problems are entirely different. What do you all do when you all think of things? What you do is you try to get into a network and get it to misbehave. Right? That's typically what you want it to do. You want it to do something that it's not supposed to do. When we were building a box back in the 70s, it was a radio with a battery. It had two switches. One said on and off, and one said cipher or plain text. Now, if you look at, you know, we have a Windows configuration guidebook out there. It's 18 volumes, and that's literally about that big. You can't do that for a radio with two switches. Even NSA could not turn that into 18 volumes. That was only two volumes. So what could you do to get it to misbehave? There's really not a whole lot. There's something when you introduce bad information to the system, you could do that because of the fact that it had to fail to plain. So here's an anecdotal story which I have been told by my friends in the military that actually happened. I believe them. I didn't witness this, but a simple thing that happened was in Vietnam. Someone would get on a walkie-talkie and say, "Help, help, they're coming in over the East Wall." Well, that would be in the clear, and the people using our radios would immediately rush to the East Wall, at which point the guy who said that would come in over the West Wall, do whatever the plan was, and escape. That's a very simple spoofing scenario, and yet it's something that impacts us in real life. Those are the kind of things we were worried about back then. Things are very different today. Now, the key was the key. And you all know what key variables are. That really was the key. I did something, and the closest 700 people here are probably going to be able to understand this. This is an awful young crowd. Do any of you remember IBM cards? Okay. Cool. This is cool. Okay. Back in the 70s, when you talked about variables, all of you guys know RSA and that kind of stuff, and the variables are flying over the air. Didn't fly over the air back in the 70s. What did they do? Well, they were on pieces of paper. In fact, we had paper tape that was about that long that had holes in it. We had IBM cards that would slide in. Now, one of the problems with these things is when you have an IBM card, you can put it in upside down. When you do that, you have a problem. So what did they do? Well, what they did was they put this DN with an arrow in the right-hand corner to let you know that if you put it in like this, you'd have a problem. That happens to be another true story, unfortunately. And it took them a while to figure out that was happening. When you deal with things like that, you have to worry about your threat adversary model. In this case, it wasn't really an adversary that was doing it to you. The threat was that you had guys that really didn't know what was up and what was down. We've moved to a little different problem. We realized that having this hard copy of the key was a problem because it could be lost, it could be stolen, it could be sold. And that really wasn't in our threat adversary model at the time. Our threat adversary model really was that the guys who had the key were good guys, and the guys who didn't have it were bad guys. When you dealt with authenticity and integrity, the way you dealt with that back then was anybody who had this crypto variable was a good guy. And so if you got a cipher message, it came from who it said it came from, and it was good. Completely different model today. Now, back in 1971, we thought about the first over-the-air rekey. And it did not use asymmetric encryption that we think about today. It used symmetric encryption to send symmetric variables. This was a hard story to get through PAO, but I got it through, so I'm going to tell it to you because I had to fight hard enough to get it through. When we decided to do this, we decided to call this rekey variable the unique variable because, first of all, it had a unique purpose. It was for rekey rather than transmitting text. Second of all, and this was the important issue, it was supposed to be unique to every user, much like today. You know, you have your private key. That is your private key. Well, back in the 70s, this was a pretty novel concept. So we went down to the Pentagon, and we briefed some really, really important people on this issue. And we explained it to them, explained why we were doing it, explained it was because of the insider threat, and we wanted to be able to recover from that, and we wanted to be able to recover from lost variables, so that if we had a net, some guy was lost, we could use the unique to rekey everyone else. Good idea. About 3 days later, I got, email did not exist, but I got a classified letter from them saying that they really appreciated this, they thought it was a good idea, and this was the variable that they had chosen as the unique, and they sent me a bunch of ones and zeros. And I'm thinking, wait, this is the unique, and they had interpreted unique as there would be one. So we took another trip down to the Pentagon, And, you know, it's really hard to tell guys that important that you guys don't understand. So you have to say, well, you know, you did a really good job. Now, let's see if we can go back and try something again. We did get it straightened out. Now, I want to talk a little, just a little bit about assurance. And once again, if you have any questions, please jump in. Assurance is really a problem. And we're supposed to be talking about where is assurance going and how we work together. Well, when we deal with assurance, and once again, let me reiterate that I'm a crypto mathematician. Okay, and life is different for us. I assume this means I'm suddenly going to be plugged in somewhere. I'm a crypto mathematician. We are all scientists. When we talk about assurance, what we would really like to have is some number. You know, if you're going to play a video game, you read a magazine, it doesn't tell you that this is a nice game. It tells you it's an 87.5. What does that mean? Or perhaps an 8, depending on the magazine you read. What does that really mean? It doesn't mean a darn thing to you until you have a lot of numbers from other games so you can compare it. And you say, if this is an 87.5 and everything else is a 63 or 62, this must be a good game. When we talk about crypto, we can come up with a number, right? If you're talking DES, the number everybody says, 56. If you're talking AES, you have a different number. It might be 256, it might be 128, it might be 192. But you have a number, something that tells you. It does not necessarily tell you how good it is. That's the way you'd like to interpret it. It really tells you how bad it is in some sense. You know that DES is no better than 56. Could be worse. We don't know that it's worse. It sets that kind of a number on it. In my organization, we have a group of people that... Yeah, cool. In my organization, we have a group of people that look at these algorithms. They measure them. They have a metric. And they say, this is this good. And they are very happy because they have a number. We have another group of people that look at the implementation of that. They don't have a number, but they have, we were laughing a little while ago about math models, but these guys try to make math models out of the implementation, and they come up with something that's kind of close to a number. So they're pretty happy. And then we have a bunch of people that look at the system that this thing is in. And this is a world that you all are very familiar with. And they can't come up with anything that's anywhere close to a number. And that makes them very nervous. Because how can you talk about assurance when you don't have a metric that tells you what it really means, tells you whether something's good or not? We do not have that. That is a horrendous problem that we need to solve. Because how are we ever going to say something is secure when we don't have any kind of a measure to tell us that what we're saying makes any sense? And that may be heresy in some sense, but at least it's my opinion. I think that we need some kind of metric that'll tell us what kind of security we're getting in these systems. And that is a hard, hard problem. We are working on it. We are not getting very far, and it is very frustrating to us. And believe me, if you all have ideas, I would love to hear about them. Okay. Now, today, what's the problem? Well, the problem is everybody, all of our customers, all of my customers, want to have functionality. They want to have the same functionality on the job that they have at home. And that doesn't mean the same ability. That means they want it to be like a telephone. They want to push the same button and get the same response and not have to worry about having a different button at home than they have in the office. That really is the cornerstone of our COTS strategy. And we do have a COTS strategy. Our COTS strategy at NSA is wherever and whenever it's appropriate, we will use COTS products. That is a dramatic change in direction for an agency like mine that 20 years ago no one had ever heard of. I think it's the only way that we can be successful in today's world. And to do that, we really need cooperation from all of you. We need a partnership. That's where we've got to go. Now, the problem is They want all this functionality, and Dick Clark alluded to this very nicely today. Vendors sell functionality. Everybody's looking for functionality. The problem is functionality is the bane of security. Functionality provides opportunity for the adversary. We all know that. However, we also are part of the plug-and-play society. Everybody wants to take that box, take the equipment out of the box, plug it in, and be able to do everything. That is not secure. That can never be secure. What we need, and I think we're getting there, but we really need vendors to realize that for security, you can't be in that situation. The user's got to be put in a position where the average user gets the functionality that the average user needs. And if you're going to need a lot of additional functionality that's in that box, the user's got to be smart enough to enable it. Don't put the user at risk by automatically enabling all of the functionality in a box. It's a tough message, a really tough message. Now, another thing, you hear about defense in depth. Defense in depth is a very, very crucial issue for us. When I talk to people, talk to my customers, and I'm sure that you all understand defense in depth, but I'm always amazed when I talk to my customer. I go downtown, they say, yep, we got defense in depth. We got a fence with a guard, and I've got a firewall. And I say, that's not defense in depth. I mean, that's like when it's really cold and you go out and you layer clothing, that's like saying I'm layering my clothing. I'm going to put on shoes and pants and a shirt. That's not defense in depth. Defense in depth is like layering. You put on, tights and pants. You put on three shirts. That's defense in depth, so that you have multiple layers at each access point, not multiple access points with one layer. That's crucial, and I'm sure you all understand that. But the more you can help us to get that information out to the world, the better off we are. Defense in depth is a critical cornerstone of our strategy. Network is king, and that's all we hear today. And not from you all. That's what I'm hearing from the world, from my customers. Don't worry about those old problems until they really need the old problem solved, and then, of course, we've got to be doing that at the same time. We were also talking about that earlier. It seems, we all have 100 number one priority problems. But the network really is the problem that we have to face, because the legacy problems we can deal with. The legacy problems will be GOTS solutions, because there's no commercial market for most of those legacy issues. When we're dealing with nuclear command and control, very few homeowners have nuclear weapons they need to secure. Not an issue. So nobody needs this but us. And that's where we really want to make sure that only the right functionality is there, because we all want those things to be secure, and we want them to be available. That's one of the places we have to go. Okay, I've skipped around. I haven't paid any attention to this speech at all, and that's good. Now, at some point, we have to realize that we have to sacrifice functionality for security. These sacrifices have to be made. Thank you. Let me give you an example of some place where we really screwed up. We had two systems, and a customer said, I would really like to run both those systems off of one box, so I didn't have to have an extra box. And we spent a lot of time and a lot of money, and we actually found a way to do that. And I've got a friend sitting out there in the audience somewhere, probably eating a second piece of chocolate cake right now, who summed it up pretty nicely. He said, we just found an elegant solution to a problem that we should never have solved. We should have just told the guy, hey, two systems, live with it. And we shouldn't have made that sacrifice. But I like that quote. Now, we're going COTS. We have the COTS with all the functionality, and we have gone to AES. AES, everybody's familiar with AES. That's a tremendous boon for us. We plan to use that for a lot of our classified applications. And, I've heard rumors that people say, well, why isn't the government going to use AES? Believe me, we are going to use it. There's a policy that's sitting downtown right now, ready to be signed out, that talks about that. AES is the cornerstone of our future security. And I would encourage you all to go ahead and go that direction. There will be an AES suite. It's going to do what needs to be done. It's going to really make life much easier for us to use COTS products. Now, it won't be used everywhere. I said for most. We'll be talking about some areas where we need to have distinct solutions. We'll use our own stuff there, and that's where it's going to be. Now, AES, that's the easy part. You've got AES. What's the hard part? Well, the kind of hard part is actually implementing it in the correct way. That's a problem. We see this from time to time. We need to work with the private sector because we have a lot of experience in crypto. We have a lot of experience in implementing crypto. We need to work with you all to make sure that it is implemented right. Our goal is to get the COTS community to provide the best security for U.S. government and U.S. citizens that they can. A second goal would be to make U.S. industry the security provider of choice for the world. That's in the best interest of the country. But we've got to do it right, and it's very, very easy to completely circumvent security provided by an algorithm if you don't implement it well. And keep that in mind. We see it over and over again. We have people that are really, really good designers, software designers, that don't have the crypto background. And even inside a company, we see multiple implementations of the same security-related things, and they aren't all equally strong, and often they are not as strong as they could be. We need to work with you to try to solve that problem. That is a crucial problem, and we are looking forward to working with U.S. industry to get that solved. So, where is IA going? Interesting question. Now, you might think that from what I've said that we're almost giving up on assurance, and we're not. At one point in time, it was like somebody downtown had this big revelation, and they're going switching from a risk avoidance to a risk management philosophy. We never had a risk avoidance philosophy. I think somebody may have tried to interpret it that way, but we always knew we were taking a risk because we always knew that we only knew what we knew. We didn't know what we didn't know. And we never believed that we knew everything. So what we hoped was that there wasn't anybody who knew a whole lot more than we did. That might have been true back in 1980 because there wasn't a lot of competition for us. The competition, first of all, everybody was happy because the competition was, say, the Soviet Union, and if they found something wrong with something, it wasn't going to hit the newspapers, and so it didn't cause a lot of problems anyway. It didn't make us feel particularly happy about it, but we figured we did our best, and we spent a lot of resources to try to make sure that any risk we were taking was a very reasonable risk. In some sense, that is risk avoidance. We tended to err very much on the conservative side. To the extent that we would spend many, many years evaluating something before it made its way into the marketplace. Many years, 20 years. 20 years is a long time to study something. Today, the market doesn't put up with that. Nobody's going to wait 20 years for us to get a product out. It'll be technologically obsolete. It wasn't something we worried about 20 years ago. But what we're doing today is we are sharing more risk information both with our customers and with the vendor community and with you all. I think that's an important step for us to take. This is important that we work together on this information. And as Dick pointed out this morning, that information has to be shared in the right way. And he got the order exactly right. It doesn't do us any good to talk about vulnerabilities to a user, because the user can't really do much about it. What we can do with the user is we can talk about risk and how to mitigate the risk, and that's what we want to do. What we need to do, that's all of us, we need to get to the vendors. When we find a problem with their equipment, we've got to get to them, tell them as much as we can about what we've found that's wrong. As much information as you can get them makes it easier for them to work with. If you give them enough information, it's much easier for them to deal with the problem. And you know, I've been told that by vendors. The more information we get, the easier it is for us to pinpoint what's causing the problem. And that is the way we get things fixed. So that's where we are. Please, when you find problems, go to the vendor first. Get that patch out there. Okay. Now, one of the things that we need to do, particularly in our community, is we have the configuration guides. We need things to be configured correctly. This almost forces us to go to a standardization of a system. We need things to look very similar. One of the things this allows you to, and Dick Clark alluded to this. Okay, no question. Dick Clark alluded to, question or? Okay. Dick Clark alluded to this morning when he said, you know, the system admin wants to put that patch in place, but he wants to make sure it doesn't screw up his system. Well, the closer to standard that DoD systems are, the easier it is for the vendor to test that fix. If you can't really tell a vendor to go out and make sure that your patch doesn't screw up any application that's out there, unreasonable request. If you tell the vendor what the standard DoD configuration is and what applications you're using with it, you can ask them to check that, and that's reasonable. Or we can check that, and that's reasonable. But you can't check 100,000 different implementations. And when we go out and go to the field, we find that that's what we get. Everybody's got the standard configuration, but we needed to fix it a little bit because we needed this. And that makes it tough. On the other hand, when we look at something in the lab and we evaluate it and we find that, yep, this is good like this, I check. When we find that it doesn't help our users any if we say, yes, if you use it exactly like this, you're okay. Otherwise, you know, we can't tell you. You might be okay, you might not be. That doesn't do them any good because it's not serving their needs. So we have to work together to see, that's all of us, with the users too, to see what kind of needs they have to make sure we're in good shape. Okay, I've been given a 5 minute, and that means about a minute a page for what I've got left. So what kind of trends do we see? Well, we see a lot of things. We see we need to work with the standards bodies. We need to get some kind of standard implementation, and that means the freedom of implementation and design is going to go away a little bit. We need to hone in on these implementations, try to get them right, and we need to work together to do that. I see improved intrusion detection and response, possibly intelligent intrusion detection. That's coming along. I see a much stronger government, private analyst, and industry partnership. Got to happen. Another trend I see, and this is a scary one, more and more functionality is being combined into fewer boxes. You see a lot of things being put together. That's good and that's bad. It provides opportunity. So we've got to be a little careful there. Big problem that I see. You know, when I think about assurance, and I mentioned it earlier, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we had American companies, we had cleared U.S. citizens on the lines producing these things. Now, did that really provide us with any information assurance? Don't know what assurance it provided, but it was in our threat model that provided some assurance to us. There are virtually no completely U.S. companies that we deal with today. And by completely, you've got to understand that if you look at what companies are doing, and it's a software world, they're borrowing code, they're getting code off the internet, they're buying code, they're producing some code, they're carrying code forward from prior instances of the product. It is a tough problem. Oftentimes, we don't know where the code came from. Oftentimes, the vendor doesn't know where the code came from. Even if they think they do, they don't know where the code came from. We don't have the same kind of assurance that we used to have. That's why we've got to come up with some kind of scheme, some kind of metric. Now, one of the things that Dick, and I'm not going to completely agree with him here, talked about today was NIAP. NIAP does provide some good for us. It provides some check. We have no metric at all for talking about what the NIAP evaluation provides. That is a significant problem. We don't know. I personally don't have an immense amount of faith that the common criteria as written provide an adequate amount of assurance for our needs. Now, that's a pretty bold statement. There's a lot of good in the common criteria, but without a metric to talk about what evaluating to that criteria buys you, we really don't know what we're getting, and we don't have that metric. Once again, that's my opinion. That's probably not something that it did go through PAO, but I don't think it should be taken as an NSA stand on that. Okay, I talked about crypto, how you can completely bypass the strengths provided by the crypto, the security provided. You have to know things like modes. The AES thing is going through a modes analysis right now. I don't know if you know about that. That's very important. Modes are critical. The implementation of crypto is critical, and you have to be sure, just like the implementation of crypto is important, the implementation of the implementation in the bigger system is important, because you can circumvent all of the security provided by the crypto through other functions of the system. Very important. We need to work together. Okay, I'm going to wrap right now. Testing, good software design, absolutely crucial. I'd like to get it across to people that is important. One thing I'd like to bring up that Dick brought up was Microsoft had a security month. That was an absolutely important step for U.S. industry to take. Not something to laugh at. It was a lot of money, and it was an important step. I would love to see all of industry treat security as job one. That is a very, very important thing. Now, the interesting thing is you can now sell security to the public. They understand. As the public starts to take security seriously, industry is taking security seriously as well. I don't think those are completely independent, but they are very, very important. You can sell security. Do it. We encourage U.S. industry. Take security seriously. We want to work with you. And I'd like to also say that we have configuration guides that are available. Please use those. And please give us feedback. We have been provided feedback, both positive and negative. All that feedback is very, very important. It's allowed us to, these are living documents, it's allowed us to update them, to make them better and better. So where are we going? Let me before you jump up here, Jack, let me say, okay, where are we going? Well, we're going to a world where security solutions are created by melding together many COTS products. It's a world where the components work together and where we all work together to make sure that COTS security is sufficient for our needs. Now, it may be for DOD that there are GOTS slices. It may be that there are some places that are completely GOTS. And it may be that COTS solves every one of our needs. That would be wonderful for us, because you all can build things faster, better, cheaper than we can. We understand that. We want to work to make it not only faster, better, cheaper, but secure. Defense in depth, got to emphasize that. That's where we're going to get our security from. I'd like to just close by saying that I believe that U.S. industry is the best in the world. I think that U.S. private analysts are the best in the world. I'd like to think that government analysts are the best in the world. Now, that's a great combination. There's also an interesting problem. The fact that we are good also makes us the primary target for the rest of the world. We are the target that everybody's shooting for. It's only by working together that we can make that target really hard to hit. And that's where we've got to go. Thank you very much.
so much for sticking to my speech.
You did good. Thanks, Dickie. That was very good. You had a thing about a problem with the children? They sound old enough to be parents. Their children will be like them, so you'll get payback. To get information about NSA and the NIAP program, if you go to www.nsa.gov, you can follow up on some of Dickie's pointers during the conference. I have a couple of announcements here. At 1:30, the wired hubs should be available next to BindView up on the fourth floor, and the wireless should be operational. If you do need a wireless card, the store near the registration has some wireless capabilities, the Lucent gold cards, and you can check there. The conference will resume at 1:30 on the fourth floor. Thank you.